The Metis Tech Show.
Welcome to the Metis Tech Show, a show for HVAC professionals by HVAC professionals.
The Metis Tech Show.
All right, so we just went through Girl Scout cookie season like a month ago. There were all those boxes out there. People saw them.
Yes.
Yeah, Steve, what's your go-to Girl Scout cookie?
So my favorite is the peanut butter patties.
Are those the like the little sandwich? Are those ones with the chocolate around them, or the little?
Yeah, it's got the chocolate on the outside and soft peanut butter in the middle with a crunchy cookie on the bottom.
See, I like,
and it's just amazing.
I like the peanut butter sandwich cookies. It's just, I don't know what kind of, it's a peanut butter cookie with peanut butter in the middle. Those I like. I like the shortbreads.
Yeah,
and they go by different names, like. I've heard them, I think they're called Dosi-Dos or Samoas or whatever, but the ones with a little fudge and coconut on them.
Yes.
Those are Samoas. Samoas.
But so good.
But they call them different things, different parts of the country.
Oh, really?
Yeah, I've noticed that. The one
And the peanut butter patties are actually considered vegan, believe it or not.
Really?
Yeah. So I'm looking this up right now. I don't know the stuff off the top of my head. I'm looking at all the Girl Scout flavors.
We know how to feel about vegan.
Lemonades.
Well, those are good.
Those are great. So the peanut butter sandwiches you're talking about don't have chocolate on them. They're just
I love those.
Crunchy cookie on the outside, peanut butter in the middle.
I can eat a whole box of those, which is not saying much because the boxes are getting smaller and smaller and the prices are getting higher and higher. But I think it's like 6 cookies to a box now. So it's not that much. But I'm going to tell you, they're probably the most popular, but they're the absolute worst cookie in the world. Is the Thin Mints. Those are disgusting. I can't stand those.
Oh, they're awesome. Thin Mints are great.
Chocolate and mint are two flavors that just don't go well together. I don't understand how people like that. They're just awful.
Mint Oreos. Have you tried the mint Oreos now?
No, I will not try mint Oreos, no.
Oh, man. Don't even get me started. They got all these new Oreo flavors. They got lemon Oreos now. They got...
those are probably good.
They got
the vanilla Oreos.
Coffee flavored Oreo cookies.
You know what I like? You know what I like that's coffee flavored? Coffee. That's it. I don't like anything else coffee flavored except coffee.
What about coffee cake?
Well, that's doesn't even taste like
what about coffee ice cream?
Coffee
ice cream is unbelievable. I love it.
It's good. Okay. Well, it's because it's ice cream. You know, I bet you if they made a spinach ice cream, it would be good. I doubt it. Actually, I take that back.
I doubt it.
Yeah.
So they also make Adventurefuls, which is a brownie. So these are the names of the cookies they got now. So just going by what I'm reading, Paul, don't give me a hard time, man. No. Adventurefuls are brownie cookies. They're brownie with a caramel-flavored cream topped with sea salt. Sounds amazing.
Yeah, it does sound good.
What about Caramel Delights?
Yeah, those are
I thought those were called macaroons.
Aren't those the ones with the coconut on them?
Yes.
Yeah, they call them Samoas. They used to be called, I think they're Dosi-Do. Those are the ones that, for some reason, they're, depending on where you are, what part of the country, the name is different. I don't know why. But I tell you what, every Easter, my wife and a bunch of ladies at church get together and they bake dozens and dozens of cookies. And then they swap them with each other. They bring them home and then they drop a bunch of them off at the police and the fire stations. But the one thing, it's actually every Christmas, not Easter. Sorry. But my wife made these cookies last year. And I think Michelle here in the office in Boston made these before. But it's basically an oatmeal raisin cookie with chocolate chips and butterscotch chips.
Wow.
Oh, yeah. They were just there the other day.
Yeah. Those were, she had them in the freezer and she brought them in. Those were good. You can't,
you can't just eat
one cookie. You got to, you know, go lock them up, put them away. And, you know, they're just wicked good.
Yeah.
So it's appropriate that we're talking about cookies because everybody loves the Cookie Monster. Cookie Monster. What was that? Are you playing with the controls over there?
The wrong button. Right.
Today's episode, because last week we did M&P by the numbers. Today we're doing City Multi by the numbers. So today's episode is brought to you by the numbers 656, 1640, 32, 1650, 11, 295, 6, 54,000, 164, 360, 624, 4,000, 1500, 500, and 1. All right.
Okay.
So, lots to unpack there.
Yeah. So we started to do this the last episode. We were kind of just spitballing and, you know, I don't know what we call that. But when we started it towards the middle of that or towards the end, assigning these numbers. So I kind of like that.
Yep.
So I'm going to give you guys a number, and this is like a game show. You guys got to tell me what it is. And the prize at the end is just a brown paper bag full of nothing.
Oh, great.
All right. So, Steve, the first number goes to you. 656.
Yes. So that's MNET. Your MNET daisy chain from the outdoor unit to the farthest indoor unit. That's our maximum MNET run.
Period.
That's 16.2 stranded shielded wire.
And that's going from the outdoor unit to the branch box, if there is one, and daisy chaining all the different indoor units in any order, no particular order. You don't have to go, if it's an R2, you don't have to go to the branch box first. You're going to go to the closest unit, shortest line between two distance. That daisy chain, the maximum length is 656 feet. Bryn,
yes.
The next number is to you, 1,640.
So 1,640 is the maximum total MNET transmission cable. So this includes not only our daisy chain, but also wiring from TB7, any of our ME controllers. The total amount of MNET wire allowable in that system is 1,640.
Okay. Steve, the next number is 32 feet.
So 32 feet is referencing the maximum wire length to our ME controllers. So we have one model ME controller. And it speaks MNET language. It's on the MNET. It gets addressed. That maximum length is 32 feet.
So from the MNET to controller to whichever TB5 you're landing it on, whatever indoor unit you're landing on, that's a maximum of 32 feet. Is that 32 feet included in the 656?
Not part of the 656.
Not part of the 656. Correct. But what happens if I exceed that 32 feet? Can I exceed it?
No, you cannot exceed that 32 feet on the controller side.
All right. Brent, I believe it's your turn. 16 is your number.
So 16 signifies the maximum number of units an ME controller can control. So the way that the ME is set up is it gets wired into TB5, and the only units it controls is done by address structure. So if it's address 5 that it's hooked to, you might give it an address of 105. It's going to control 16 units down that MNET bus or until it sees another ME.
Okay. So I can control. So that would actually be handy if I have like a big hall or a church, for instance, and I've got more than one indoor unit in that big space.
Yes.
Instead of getting a controller for each one, I'm just going to address it appropriately or properly, I should say. And I'm going to control that with one ME.
Yeah.
That's a good number.
We call that grouping.
Grouping. Steve, 50.
Yeah, so 50, we're talking about how many indoor units can be on a city multi-system or on the MNET bus. So because where indoor units get an address range of 1 to 50, and because that's the maximum indoor units that we can connect to any given outdoor unit, that's where that 50 comes from. So
it's 50.
Maximum of 50.
It's 50 for our largest unit, but this is when you go to, we said this last time, read that manual, right? Read the fantastic manual, because not every unit can take 50.
Right.
It's going to be different based on the capacity of the unit. So an indoor unit is, that's easy to understand. It's an indoor unit. But are there other components that take up an indoor address that we should know about?
Yep. I mean, our loss unit gets an address. So our ERV, that gets an address. Remote control.
Yeah, DIDO,
and indoor
DIDO boards, AI controllers, PI controllers, our pulse controllers for energy apportionment. All of those components get indoor unit addresses.
LEV kit gets an indoor unit address.
Yeah.
Yep. Good. Yep. Good to know. Bryn, back to you. 11.
11 is the number, maximum number of sub-BCs on an R2 NGEN system.
All right, so I can have one main up to 11 BCs. That's a nice system to pipe.
Yeah. I just wanted to touch base really quick with that 52 is that does not mean that we can't have more than 50 units on a particular job site when it comes to indoor units. It's just about the MNET bus. So when I say, when we say 50 is the maximum number of indoor units, you could have three different systems that all have 50 right. on there, and they can be brought together through a central controller.
Right.
Good point.
It's just the MNET bus and not the maximum allowed.
Correct. It's 50 indoor units per outdoor units.
Right.
Right. For our largest system. Mm-hmm. Yep. Good point.
Yep.
Steve, 295.
295 feet is the maximum pipe distance to furthest indoor unit. You got to look at your install manual to confirm with every system you're installing, especially the newer systems that are coming out now, the newer generation, the Dash A's. Those numbers may change. So always consult your install manual.
Yeah, and we mentioned this the last time, too. It's the manual is absolutely important, but mm-hmm. Diamond System Builder can save you a lot of headaches. If you put this system, before you even install it, before you even go out to the job site, there should be a Diamond System Builder file, and there should be some lengths in there, at least some estimates. Yes. So you know if you've exceeded one of these, right? And then you do the as-built afterwards. So Diamond System Builder.
Sounds good.
So what's the next number? It looks like it's six?
Six. So six is the number of feet between the outdoor unit and twinning kit before an inverted trap becomes necessary. So if we have two outdoor units being twinned together and the distance from that outdoor unit to the twinning kit where the two units come together, if that exceeds 6 feet, we need to put an inverted trap in there of at least 7 7/8 inches of height.
Right. And that's in the instructions for the twinning kit that comes with that.
Yes.
Because we always say there's no traps necessary, no traps necessary. When we say that, what we mean is the rule of thumb that's in refrigeration and HVAC. There's a rule of thumb for every so many feet of rise, you add an inverted trap. When we say there are no inverted traps needed in our system, we're referring to that specific rule of thumb that's an industry standard. We don't want to see those there. But in this case, that six, the twinning kit instructions will actually say that you'll need that trap if you're exceeding that 6 feet. So that's clear.
And that's, again, just for oil return primarily. What can happen is because there's really no way of knowing which unit has more refrigerant at any one given time, depending on what mode they're in, what stage they're in, that inverted trap is going to make sure that we keep oil in that further outdoor unit.
And our next number, Steve, it's to you. It's 54,000.
So 54,000 BTUs is what we're talking about here, is what one port can accommodate for BTUs on a branch controller. So if we want to exceed that with a larger 72,000 and 96,000 BTU units, then we're going to use two ports. We have to twin two ports together. So that doesn't mean grab a bunch of fittings and braze in some monstrosity. we're going to order the Y fitting, twinning fitting that will twin those two ports together. It's pre-measured, pre-brazed. And does a great job. It comes with insulation that you can insulate that as well.
Little clamshell insulator. And that's two adjacent or consecutive or sequential ports. So you can't twin port 3 and port 7. It's got to be 3 and 4 because the port assignment from the indoor unit, if it's going to know it's larger than 54,000 BTUs, and if you're going to assign it to port 3, it knows to open port 3 and 4.
Right.
But Bryn, that's different on the hybrid VRF now, right?
Yes. So with our hybrid VRF, our larger units for the hybrid VRF offering is 36,000 and 48,000 BTUs. And in both of those instances, you would need two twin ports. But everything else still applies. All the same rules apply. It has to be adjacent ports. You give it the one port assignment, it's going to automatically know it's assigned to both.
For those that don't know what hybrid is, it's our refrigerant to water system. So it's not our full refrigerant system, VRF system that we're used to. Our hybrid VRF is refrigerant from the outdoor unit to the hybrid branch controller, and then from the branch controllers to the indoor units is water, hot water and chilled water simultaneously.
Yep.
All right.
And just before we move on to the next one, the other thing with the 54,000 BTUs on an R2 system, that's the max of BTUs allowed if we are putting up to three indoor units on a single port. So we have the ability of doing that, putting three small, let's say you have 39,000 BTUs for three smaller offices, you can use a single port for those three. Only thing with that is they're all in the same mode, so we don't get simultaneous heating and cooling on that those particular heads because they're all in the same port.
Right. Yeah. So you may not want to do that for three different offices, but if it's a common area, a larger area,
auditorium,
maybe you can do that. But but the same mode, same set point, everything. One controller for those three if they're on the same port.
Yep.
Yeah. Right. Not a lot of people know we can do that. We can put three units on one port.
Yep. Bryn, why don't you take the next one? 164.
164 is our height difference from the OC to the IC or the outdoor unit to our furthest indoor unit. So again, it's height vertical separation. So where that outdoor unit is mounted, and that can include a rooftop. So if that outdoor unit is mounted on the roof, we have 164 feet of vertical separation. So we can go down 164 feet before we get to that indoor unit. That's our max.
All right. Good to know. Steve, 360 is your next number.
360 feet max distance from the outdoor unit to the branch controller. That's our maximum. But again, with all of these numbers, you have to consult and look at your install manual and make sure, because this measurement here, this 360 feet max distance from the outdoor unit to the branch controller, that is going to affect your overall piping length. You have to look at the chart, and again, what's the easiest? We have software that does this, right? We have Diamond System Builder that will figure all this stuff out for us.
Yes.
But if we go that total 360 feet, remember that our total equivalent line length lessens a little bit. So
that is directly ties into our maximum overall line length, as Steve said. So keep that in mind. And you can either RTFM, read that fantastic manual, or you can use Diamond System Builder and build this ahead of time.
I applaud anybody that will install an R2 system without a DSP on hand.
I wouldn't do it. I've said this before, and people have criticized me.
A huge risk to take.
Yeah, people have criticized me for saying this, and I don't know why, but if I'm a contractor, I am not starting an installation without a DSB.
Mm-hmm.
At least a printout of the DSB that shows it was designed with DSB with estimate line lengths in there.
Yep.
You know, a DSB with zero for every dimension is no help at all. You need to have some numbers in there. The person designing this should know, approximately how many feet this is, because they're going to have a building plan to look at. They have a plan to build a DSB, so let's build a plan for this. And we all know it doesn't go according to plan, but if I'm going to guess at a distance, I'm going to guess a little bit high, and that way I know the chances of me exceeding that are pretty slim.
And that goes into, not to turn this into a DSB thing, but if you're engineering a job, if you're not taking a pretty decent estimate of your line set lengths, you're not going to get the proper heating and cooling output of that unit. So if you're trying to do sizing and you're just putting in zeros, or you're just saying everything's 50 feet, you're not even going to know what your heating and cooling output of that unit's going to be anticipated to be without putting in something that's pretty close to what it's going to end up being.
Yeah. So the good news is most of our people designing this know what they're doing. Mm-hmm. They know this. They're wicked smart people. So we don't see that issue a whole lot, but I have talked to contractors who showed up to a job without a DSB. I go, make sure you ask one, get one. All right, and the next number, I believe, is 600/24. We talked about this in the last week, so we don't want to beat a dead horse, but let's just go over this again, 600/24.
Yeah, so 600 PSI for 24 hours, and, we kind of made a joke about the recommendation of 24 hours. Obviously, a one-to-one may not be able to get away with a 24-hour pressure check, but when we're talking R2, city multi, large series, systems, you need to take your time, do that 24 hours, and be sure.
Yeah, build that into your labor. You need to account for that, because
we're not talking about 20 pounds of refrigerant. We're talking about 100 plus. So we don't want to lose that.
Pressurize it with nitrogen, 600 PSIG, and let it sit there for 24 hours. If you come back 24 hours later and there hasn't been a huge change in temperature and you still got the 600 pounds in there, chances are very good that you don't have a leak.
Yep.
But the next three numbers are a way to ensure you don't have a leak. And Steve, I'll give this one to you. It's 4,000, 1,500, and 500. I know we just talked about this last week, but let's just quickly go through it again.
Yeah, so triple evacuations, industry standard. It's nothing Mitsubishi came up with. This has been around for forever. It's just a lot of us have been taught bad habits over the years. But when you're doing a triple evacuation, you're trying to get rid of non-condensables, the big one being moisture in the system. So the idea behind this is where we're pulling down to 4,000 microns, and we're going to equalize the system with nitrogen. We're going to sweep some nitrogen in and bring that up to atmospheric, zero PSI. And then we're going to continue to evacuate down to 1,500 microns. And same thing, we're going to break with nitrogen again. And then down to 500 microns or below. And we're going to conduct, and this goes into the next one, our one-hour rise test. So we're going to have to make sure that we have clean vacuum pump oil in the system, that we have a good setup for pulling a vacuum. Mm-hmm. Manifolds are not always the right choice for your vacuum. You want to have kind of consolidate things down to a couple of hoses, vacuum rated hoses, core removal tools that have valves on them so you can isolate the micron gauge to see the system side. And once you're down below 500 microns, again, do your 1 hour rise test and your microns will rise, but they will also stop at a certain point. So I'll give you an example. Pull down to 300 microns, and you may see it go up to about 400, 450 microns and stop. Now, if it keeps going, it keeps going, you either have a leak or you have moisture in the system, or you have some kind of refrigerant that maybe you're doing a repair on an existing system. Keep in mind that the refrigerant will sit in that oil in that compressor and boil off, and that will drive you completely crazy. It's done it to me out in the field and trying to get rid of that refrigerant, and you're trying to do a rise test and microns keep rising. So depending on what you're doing, if it's a brand new installation, we should be able to do a 1 hour rise test and your microns should not rise much from 300 or 500 microns.
So a couple of months ago, we did actually a triple evac episode with Ralph Wolf. And you know, so I don't want to beat that to death, but I do want to say this. I've heard other podcasts and I've heard people say, and contractors tell me, you don't need to do a triple evac if you're doing the whole system, everything's brand new. You got a brand new indoor unit, you got a brand new outdoor unit, your line set would just run. So why do you need to do a triple evac? You know, what's the harm? A triple evac is going to get down below the 500 microns quicker than a single evacuation. You know, and if you did everything all on the same day, yeah, you're probably right. You might get away with it with a single evacuation, but I don't recommend it. Mm-hmm. Always do a triple evac. Now, here's the thing. A lot of everything's new, right? But I've seen line sets out there roughed in that are not sealed. I've seen line sets out there sticking through the roof, aiming straight up with electrical tape on the end. Guess what? Yeah. There's rain water. If it's been there for days and weeks, there's moisture in that system in the form of water. You need to do a triple evac. Mm-hmm. And we mentioned this last week. You need to change your vacuum pump oil. If that vacuum, if it's taking slow, if it's going down slowly, start with fresh vacuum pump oil and then see what happens. But you need to do it.
The other thing,
and remember, we're talking about city multi-systems. We're talking, you know, a Y-series system can have over 3,000 feet of pipe overall piping. That's a lot of pipe. You know, it's going to take some time to do this correctly on, you know, talking city multi versus residential where you got a smaller system.
Yeah, the other thing I was going to say is even if it's all brand new, you'd still have to put a lot of faith in supply houses and your warehouse that those pipes were sealed the entire time. And I know, you know, when I was in a van, we had, you know, a big pile of line set and we did a pretty good job at making sure it was protected while it wasn't being used. But every once in a while, you'd get around like a 164 foot roll that somebody cut the end off of and now it's open to the atmosphere.
Yeah.
And it's brand new line set, but it's been absorbing that moisture and having moisture get in there the whole time. Yep. So
good point. Good point. So I think the horse is dead. So right. You know, and we're going to finish this the way we did last week. The next number is not one that we can give you. It's a one that you have to get. Is if you need some technical support, your first person you should talk to is call your distributor, find out who their DSG member is, the Diamond Service Group. They're there to support you. And if you need to, we have our own 800 number, the Mitsubishi Tech Support. It's 1-800-433-4822. They're there to help you as well.
And also come to our trainings.
MitsubishiComfort.com. Go to For Professionals and Pros and look for the classes coming up. And attend the training. That's probably the best thing that you can do. So yeah. I think we're done with the numbers, right?
I think so. I think we got them.
All right. Thanks, guys. Steve, enjoy Orlando. We forgot to mention you're joining us virtually.
So for Easter,
yeah,
I went up to my sister's house, and she ordered these cookies from a bakery. And I actually didn't know they were cookies because they were like a almost like an oval shape. Like they were like a big mound. And inside of the cookie, when you opened it, was like marshmallow or like a brownie or something. So they were filled stuffed cookies, and they were amazing.
I think I just gained a pound just listening to you.
Yeah, she ordered 7. Yeah. And we just kind of cut little pieces off of each one because there was like all different flavors, cookie butter, yeah, snickerdoodle.
That's the thing about cookies. There's a million different cookies out there, and some of them are so simple. You know, when I was a kid, you know, I used to love Chips Ahoy. Right? Really? It's just a basic chocolate chip cookie, right? But I used to take a cup of milk. Mm-hmm. I used to put one Chip Ahoy cookie into the milk and let it sink to the bottom. And the rest you dip, and you know, you dip it into the milk, right? And then at the end, the one that you put in there initially, when you drink that milk, it's all just basically
cookified.
Yeah, oh yeah, it's so good.
You know, I've never had milk and cookies.
Are you,
oh,
what?
Oh my gosh, Steve.
I don't like milk. I don't like milk.
Because you've never had it with cookies.
Yeah, but the cookies make the milk actually taste good.
I've never had cereal with milk.
Wow.
I've eaten cereal dry just out of the box. But
you have some serious issues.
I think what ended up happening is as a child, as a baby, I ended up, someone gave me some rancid milk or something at some point. I never liked it. It was so, you know, it's an issue that I've dealt with all my life. But I it sounds so good, like dipping an Oreo cookie in milk and eating it. But so the Italian restaurant that we go to, we went to this one, Paul, Boca, the used to be the Pasta House.
Yeah, yeah.
They have a dessert, and it's the chocolate chip cookie. But what they do is they use a small, like a really tiny cast iron pan.
Yep.
Right. It's a little tiny, probably about 4 or 5 inches in diameter. They put the cookie dough in there and they bake it, and then they throw a scoop of vanilla ice cream on top of it. So you're eating this soft, warm, freshly baked cookie with the, it's just unbelievable.
I've made that cookie at home, except I use an 11 inch cast iron pan.
There you go.
Or 12 inch, I think, whatever it is. All right, guys. Thanks. We'll see you on the next one.